Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Just a quick heads up before today's From Free. My microphone was broken during the whole recording, which is just great. So apologies in advance for the sound quality. It will be back to its usual standards next week. Enjoy the podcast. It is Thursday, guys. It's time for Front Free Q&A. Adam Ball here alongside Nico Morales.
Your throat all good, Adam? You all good there, bud?
It's good as always. And Chris Enage is here as well.
I also care about your throat.
Thank you. I appreciate the concern. There is so much to talk about tonight, guys. We've got a crack on. So much going on in the world of football. Not only World Cup squad announcements, not only the Europa League final, plenty of news, Everton, West Ham, Rafa Benitez, all sorts going on, as well as your questions, of course, as always, on a Thursday. Shall we kick off, though, with Hold of the Week, guys? I haven't done Hold of the Week for a while, but let's do it. We've got three new reviews. I'll go through them very briefly. First off, we've got Jake Refault, who says, by far my favourite podcast, 5 stars, always look for it at the start of the week. Love the opinions and debates from Chris, Nico and Adam. Just a shame you don't mention Chelsea very often. Love the podcast, keep it up. Definitely worth the Patreon that is coming. Thank you very much, Jake, for the kind words. We've also got a review here from Alex Ryder, who said, guess who's back? Great to have you guys back, boys, every single week. Thank you so much for that review, Alex. But potentially my favourite, not a bad review, 4 stars, not 5 stars, simply entitled Get Rid of Nico. Good podcast, very informative and very discussions. However, too much MLS. It's a tin pot league. And please get rid of the plastic Man City yank. He is the most embarrassing thing about the podcast. Nico.
Joke's on you because I'm not American and I don't support City. So.
Which of those three reviews should win, do you think, this week, Nico, for Hold of the Week?
The third one. I got to go with
you. Do you think so?
The guy doesn't like him. Why not? Wow. Yeah, give it to him. I mean, I'm a nice guy. If he genuinely believes that I'm the worst part of this podcast, I appreciate him voicing his opinion. I cannot be less American, and unfortunately, I cannot be less of a Manchester City fan, but yes. I will try to improve for him.
Wow. Joe Webbs, there you go. The shock winner of all of the week. You got yourself some Ferrero Rocher, so slide into those DMs. Slide into Nico's DMs. There's some sweet irony there.
Yeah, I'll give you something.
Slide into Nico's DMs to claim his Ferrero Rocher, and we'll sort you out, Joe, we promise. Guys, if you want to be a Hold of the Week, if you want to say mean things to Nico, to me, to Chris, or you want to say nice things, you want to give us a 5-star review, either way, you could be in a shout of being a Hold of the Week, winning those Ferrero Rocher. Click the link in the description of the podcast to review the Front Three. It is very much appreciated. On that note, let's move on to the England squad. Guys, the England squad was released for the World Cup just yesterday by Gareth Southgate. Some controversy there. I mean, for me, it's hard to disagree with a lot of Gareth Southgate's decisions, but I'm going to play devil's advocate here. And I'm going to say, Chris, that it's an absolute travesty that Jack Wilshere is not in this squad. England are lacking a natural playmaker, and Jack Wilshere is that footballer. Why is he not going to Russia?
Because he's not reliable, essentially. Now, I think you can characterize that in two ways. Firstly, he does have an injury record. That's a problem. That is an issue that you have to consider, because if it gets day one of the tournament and he pulls up with a hamstring problem or any kind of issue, that means it's kibosh for the tournament. So that's a problem. that's been held against him, rightly or wrongly. Also, and this is just me speaking as someone that's been able to catch a decent amount of Arsenal games, I don't think he's been that sensational either. I think he's looked good in the Europa League. But again, that's a totally different competition. There's a lot of different moving parts with that. But I don't think he's dominated in the Premier League by any stretch. And so I think it's not terribly dissimilar to the last tournament. You're kind of, if you were picking him, you're picking him on the hope that he produces something he once did.
I mean, it's not necessarily he's been incredible this season or world-class, Nico, although he has played a fairly consistent run of games, more appearances this season than in recent memory for the Gunners. But yet, does he not possess those qualities that perhaps the England squad is lacking? It's worth having him in that squad to bring that to Russia.
I think what he brings to the table, and I think this is what a lot of people want to underline, and the majority of the reactions I've seen to the squad have been largely like, it's really weird. I think it's a phenomenon that's almost exclusive to English fans, but like they tend to like characterize very specific things about one player's game and think that like they just bring that one thing to the table, and it's like this weird aggregation of leadership and grit and, you know, the players that they perceive to be able to quote unquote pick a pass. Like, I think the main thing here in the conversation that we're having about Jack Wilshere is that England are lacking in the central midfield department. That is the overwhelming connotation that I think a lot of people have of this squad. You have Delph, who's played largely at left back this season, even though, as I got into a few discussions with people on Twitter over the past couple of days, like, it wasn't really a left back position. He was doing a lot of central midfielder actions within that, but you know, whatever. Then Henderson, Dyer. And then, you know, you have Loftus-Cheek, you have Lingard, who's not really a central midfielder, but outside of those guys, there really aren't, they really don't have that connection. And I think it'll largely obviously depend as to how England play, what setup they go with, how they accentuate or, you know, choose to expose those midfielders that they play. But that's, I think, the calling for Jack Wilshere here is that a lot of English fans feel that the connection from the back to the front or the transition or the opponents that they'll face, especially if they happen to get into the latter stages of the competition, will be largely midfield focused. And when you only have the variety of midfielders that seem to be on the squad right now, if, you know, an injury happens or they change something, then obviously that'll be different. I can see why people are actually calling for him, even though he hasn't been, as Chris rightly mentioned, very good or very consistent. I mean, I can see it because there is a genuine lack of a large amount of central midfielders.
Would he be in your squad, Nico? Yes or no?
I think I would struggle to say yes. If I'm Gareth Southgate, I would struggle to say yes, but at the same time, I can definitely see the merit of it. I think in the past, I would have said, you know, this is just another one of those things where Arsenal fans are being extremely vocal and there are people in the media that are willing to champion that idea. But at the same time, I think what the England squad has right now is good because they are clearly moving towards a concise style of play. At the same time, I think if Oxlade-Chamberlain doesn't get injured, he's clearly in this team and maybe the debate about Jack Wilshere isn't as prominent.
Well, one person who certainly does believe Jack Wilshere should have been in the squad is Jack Wilshere. His tweets this evening, Jack Wilshere said, "I think it's about time I had my say. It goes without saying that I'm naturally incredibly disappointed to have been left out of the England squad for the World Cup. I felt fit, sharp and strong all season and believe I should be in the squad and have been given the chance to make a real impact. However, I respect the manager's decision. I'd like to wish the whole squad all the best in the tournament. I'll always be an England fan, blah, blah, blah." He's absolutely fuming, Chris. Is he justified in that? I mean, would he be in your squad, yes or no?
He would not be in my squad.
Yeah. To me personally, I can see the merit of Jack Wilshere. I think, as you guys have outlined, he's definitely a useful player, and he could prove or could have proved to be in the squad. But at the same time, I just don't think it's worth including him. Another midfielder who potentially was controversial, but again, I just don't see the reasons personally for his inclusion, was Jonjo Shelvey. Chris, would you go along with that? Would he have been in your squad?
Yeah, but I'm maybe not the best person to ask you because I'm a little bit biased. You're
incredibly biased.
And look, the reason I say, to be fair, my opinion is not without fact behind it, or experience of at least watching him on a weekly basis. And even then, I think it's important to to stress that when I say yes, he would be in my squad, it doesn't mean he would be starting with the captain's armband. That would be Jamal Lascelles, obviously. But jokes aside, like, the reason that I would champion for him to go is so England have a plan B. It's not necessarily that he is this player that can change the way that they drastically play from the outset. But the truth is, I get Liverpool fans who say Jordan Henderson can play accurate long balls and this. But I've sat and watched Jonjo Shelvey put it on a player's foot for the last 5-6 months, maybe even longer, but not consistently. From a variety of angles with different sort of feet, all this kind of stuff. Like, his passing is a fantastic asset, and I get what everyone will say about his shortcomings, but I've got so little time for anyone that says he is not a fantastic passer of the ball, and whose response is that his pass completion is 72%. Like, I'm sorry, that's such an argument lacking in nuance to me.
What about the other notable mission, Nico? Joe Hart, of course, who hasn't really had the best season at West Ham, I think it's fair to say. Hasn't really had the best a couple of years in his career. But there is that case to be made. You've taken three keepers to the World Cup. Gareth Southgate selected Jack Butland, Jordan Pickford. It's not 100% clear who's going to be the number one, but I think he's expected it's going to be Jordan Pickford. And in that third spot, he's gone for Nick Pope, whereas the argument would be go for Joe Hart, bring that experience along, bring that know-how. As the third place keeper, he's not going to play, but there's an asset there. There's qualities that will bring something to that squad as opposed to another young, inexperienced goalkeeper. What do you make of that argument?
I think, talking about the reaction, maybe more specifically, that Joe Hart has had to not being included into the squad is something that I think is consistent with his personality. I think for a long time, and Chris was talking about this before we started recording, but for a long time, like, a lot of people told him that he was without a doubt the best goalkeeper in England. He was always going to be the number one. He was the best shot stopper. And then within two years, things have massively changed for him. He's gone from playing for Manchester City, who have very clearly moved on and moved on well without him, to playing for a West Ham team that was very much in trouble at different points in the season. And I think that his career path is only going to continue along that line, because he is a pretty unidimensional goalkeeper. He is decreasing in his ability to save shots, especially a weaker left side that has always been an issue, even at his peak. And even though I think there were a lot of people that were willing to champion the idea that he's going to work on his footwork, he's going to work on his passing, because you can see here at Torino in one game, he attempted the most passes of any goalkeeper in the league. And that's fine and great, but he really hasn't done a whole lot outside of that. And he hasn't taken that maybe difference in position now with a whole lot of grace. And I think the goalkeepers that England have taken offer a variety of approaches. Chris, I think, very highly speaks about Jordan Pickford's distribution. I personally like Jack Butland for the combination of attributes that he has, and Nick Pope has been pretty good in terms of a shot-stopping ability. And obviously all of this, and this is something that we don't talk about, I think, often enough when it comes to goalkeepers, but all of this will obviously be largely dependent on how England want to use their goalkeeper, if they're going to use it in a prominent way with the ball at their feet, or if they're going to need, you know, a goalkeeper that's extremely aggressive in coming off their line because of how they're going to be playing. I think they've taken the right goalkeepers, and Joe Hart definitely doesn't add anything to that, especially with the kind of attitude that we know him to be able to have at these competitions.
Yeah, I think for those reasons you outlined, it looks like Jordan Pickford may well be being the number one. Overall, Chris, thoughts on the squad? I mean, Gary Cahill, the most capped player, the most experienced player, is an incredibly young England team. But I think it's quite exciting to see some of these players going. I think, you know, Gareth Southgate, I don't necessarily think, as he said in his press conference earlier today, that his selection can be seen as a gamble. It's hard to argue with that squad on the whole.
I think so. I think, look, there was a lot made. I actually did Counterattack, one of the SiriusXM shows last night, and the point was made that there's not a huge wealth of experience in this team, at least internationally. And I think that's true, but I also think maybe Southgate has looked at this and thought, well, you know, there's also a lot of bad memories in the older players in this squad. There's a lot of disappointment, there's a lot of frustration, possibly even a lot of negative character and mentality. So why not give those lads a fresh chance? I think the problem you have is that you're always really going to have sort of nitpicks about the squad. I mean, we haven't even talked about the fact Ryan Bertrand didn't make it when he's been pretty, I would say, solid for a good 2 years, and yet Ashley Young is seen as a more viable left-back option, which is not to say that Ashley Young has been bad, but it highlights to me the conjecture that often follows a squad announcement. And I think that, yes, Gareth hasn't picked the most versatile squad, I think. There's not a huge wealth of difference in the players. I think there are a lot of the same kind of player. But if his system works, then he's going to look like a genius. If, you know, it gets to that awkward sort of last 10, 15 minutes against Tunisia and we need a goal, then we're going to be lamenting, you know, why we didn't bring more variety or whatever. I think in that ways, World Cups, tournaments, internationals, whatever, always feel steeped in hindsight because inevitably everyone says something about the squad that can be then proved.
Other big squad announcements for the World Cup, of course, being made this week. France naming their squad, incredibly strong-looking squad, Nico, and they can afford
is
to
it
leave
though?
Out the likes.
Is it though?
Well, they can afford to leave out the likes of Anthony Martial, Alexandre Lacazette, and Dimitri Payet, and still looks.
Aymeric Laporte.
Exactly, and it still looks pretty good to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really strong squad. I think I was having this conversation with somebody earlier about between sort of France and Spain, there is a Mariana's Trench worth of sort of depth to choose from. So they're not necessarily struggling to find the players. But yeah, I think I'm not going to say that they're strange decisions because this is both between Deschamps and Southgate. I think they are doing things that, although I might not necessarily agree with all of the squad decisions, they are doing things that I have largely advocated both on this podcast and in other places for national team managers to do, which is don't take your best 23 players or try to cram players in just because they're very good into a team that you're not going to be able to play all of them. Take a group of players that is going to be able to execute one or two different game plans, because we can't forget, although there is a ton of games, and especially from people that are involved from a media perspective, it can seem like a tsunami of things that are coming at us at the same time. You know, one team will only play X amount of games, and that span of the World Cup really isn't that long, especially if you only play into the knockout stages and then you're out. I think he's taking a group of players that can execute the style of play that he wants to. And although I would like to see someone like Laporte in there, and I think a lot of people would say, even though Nabil Fekir has had a pretty decent year and guys like Thomas Lamar have been good in the past, it's difficult to maybe see why Dimitri Payet doesn't warrant a place, or, other player, Anthony Martial was the other notable exception, doesn't warrant a place in the squad. I think they have gone with their best idea, and we have to judge them on the result of what happens. But like I said, I don't necessarily agree with all of the personnel decisions, but I like the idea behind it, that they're going to try to play a specific style, and they chose the players that they think will be able to accentuate that properly.
Is it a similar story for Brazil, who've got some notable omissions themselves, the likes of Alexandro, maybe less contentiously, David Luiz as well, not making this one?
Yeah, I think the loss of Dani Alves was disappointing because of his experience and the fact that he is still a quality player, even if he's not maybe as mobile as he was at one stage. But I don't necessarily think mobility has been a cornerstone of his game, personally. I think, interestingly for me, it maybe gives them an option to be a little bit more solid, Brazil, because if you imagine the idea of Alves and Marcelo, who I think has become a bit more positionally undisciplined when I've seen him of late, it means they could possibly pick a right back, be it Fagner or whoever, to be sort of the watchman, the one who you know holds back when Marcelo bumps forward, who kind of covers and maybe does a little bit more of the dirty work that we associate with a fullback.
Yeah, I think there were some controversial comments from Tite, who quite clearly likes to employ the approach that I talked about earlier, more concise style of play as opposed to taking some of the better players, even though I think it's more down to personal relationships in a lot of these situations. Like Alexandro, for me, has been one of the best left backs in world football over the past couple of seasons, not just this season or last season where Juventus made it to a Champions League final. But I imagine there is something there that he's not doing. And he mentioned with the injury to Dani Alves that there are players who will be called up to the squad, or there are people within the squad that I think don't necessarily need to be or warrant a place in doing so. And I can admire to a certain extent that level of honesty, but I would wonder what that does to that certain player. Maybe he's trying to motivate them to think more along his lines. But you know, there are a dearth of really good Brazilian left backs out there playing for some of the best teams in the world. And Felipe Luis, I think he might not start all of the games, but I think he perfectly exemplifies the balance that Tite is trying to strike within this squad. He's trying to accentuate the best qualities of Neymar, that obviously at the last World Cup was one of the biggest stars and can be one of the biggest stars yet again, because if you really use him correctly and allow some of his best abilities, and I think he's evolved so much since that tournament, than just a left-sided player, but use him in a more central role, get the best out of Firmino and Willian and Coutinho even, and guys like that, and allow that attacking brilliance to kind of be unleashed, but at the same time balance that with good defensive players like Luis, like Danilo, hopefully at right back. I think that's a team really to be reckoned with. And so I think there's so much that goes into being the manager of Brazil, such a storied team at the international level. I have a lot of respect for his approach to the team.
Moving away from World Cup squads and World Cup omissions, I mean, we mentioned Dimitri Payet there. His omission from this France squad, compounding a bad week for the Frenchman, Inter, I think it's fair to say, with his side, I say, losing in the Europa League final against Atletico Madrid earlier this week. Of course, he touched the trophy, and always a big no-no.
He went off injured, right?
He went off injured in the first half. After half an hour, his side were 1-0 down. They went on to lose 3-0. Atletico Madrid winning another European final under Simeone now for Atletico Madrid in 6 years. They've reached 8 finals. They've won 6 titles there. 233 wins in total, 200 clean sheets in 6 years. An incredible record there for Simeone. And this trophy, Chris, a testament to the great work he's done there.
Yeah, I think so. And he's acknowledged the struggle as well, though. He said that to get players to kind of buy into that and maintain that level of success, it's hard because often you lose those players. I mean, the final had barely concluded. In fact, I seem to remember hearing it talked about during the actual game that this was Griezmann's sign-off, that he was going to win this competition for them and then plan his next move, whether it's Barcelona or wherever. And I think that's almost the greatest aspect of what Simeone has done for me, is the ability to continually reinvent, to find new players, to integrate them quickly and not suffer a huge drop-off. Because yeah, to draw a comparison to England and perhaps placate one of our reviewers, Chelsea have had that struggle to maintain the success. They've had success, definitely, but keeping that consistency year to year is a lot more difficult than I think people give it credit for, especially when you're not one of the elite spenders. You're not a team that is always able to go and, you know, change what you've got in front of you every summer.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, I don't mean to not diminish Atletico Madrid's. I don't mean to diminish Atletico Madrid's title win here in the Europa League, Nico, and suddenly just start talking about Diego Simeone's future. But it feels unavoidable in the sense that he has achieved so much in 6 years in Madrid. Is there a sense that perhaps he's taken the club as far as they can go? There will always be that level of evolution of the club. As Chris mentions there, Antoine Griezmann consistently linked with Barca. It looks like he could be joining this summer. There is that cycle that he continually has to go through. And even though they've moved into the new stadium, although they're still enjoying success, just think there is that sense that perhaps it's time for Simeone to move on now, or should he be staying at the club and pushing even further?
I think he should be staying at the club because there hasn't been a large departure, and I can appreciate what Chris is saying in terms of his ability to reinvent and sort of go forward with different members. And I think it will be inevitable. And there have been some Atletico fans that have complained recently, like Barcelona are already courting Griezmann in what they view to be inappropriate ways. We saw that with Liverpool in January, like Nike released, you know, get your Philippe Coutinho Barcelona jersey before the deal was even public and stuff like that. Barcelona do these things, and Atletico are very much at the whim, I think, of a lot of other European clubs that will seek to take their best players from them. But at the same time, last year was really the only year that we saw a departure from the defensive style that we so closely associate with Simeone, right? Like, they were doing really poorly trying to transform into an attacking team. And while I can appreciate that that is certainly a difficult thing to do, I still think that I'm not going to go as far to say that Atletico is Simeone's peak, but at the same time, I think we wouldn't hold him in such high regard. And I have an immense degree of respect for what he's done at Atletico, and I really admire him as a coach. But I don't really think he'd be as successful elsewhere at other clubs because of the slightly archaic style of football that he tends to want to play. And I think right now, even if Griezmann leaves, even if someone else does eventually depart, so much of what he can do and so much of what he has done is taken these younger Atletico players, some of the guys that come through the system, some of the guys that they get very early on at 18 or 19 years old, and he gets them to buy into his philosophy. And he can do that for an extended period of time. And I think Atletico can carve out that niche, not as a top European club, but as a club right beneath that. And that's okay, because there are levels to everything. Sevilla did that for a while. They won three consecutive Europa Leagues in a row. And unless you have the spending power of a City, a Real Madrid, or someone else, I think there are very slim chances that you actually achieve that European success that they all crave. And there is so much to be lost in that sense, in terms of like reaching too far that you actually fall off your post, that I think can apply to teams like Atletico that I don't think they should risk. So I think this is a good level for Simeone, at least for right now. And I want to see him stay at Atletico and continue win things.
Yeah, he himself has said he will be staying next season. He wants to continue to improve this team. And I just think the job he's done there has earned nothing but respect, despite sometimes the criticism he does draw for his style of football, which, I mean, as you described it, could be seen as archaic, which brings us very nicely on to Sam Allardyce and Everton. Allardyce has left the club sacked by the Toffees, despite finishing in ninth, in eighth place in the Premier League. What do you make of this one, Chris? Because Allardyce has come out in typical fashion and said, you know, the fans backed him more. Everton fans wanted him to stay than leave. It just felt like it never was quite the right fit, and it perhaps wasn't going to last beyond the end of the season, no matter what.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not sure where the data is coming from that more Everton fans wanted him to stay or leave.
Sam's brain, I think, is the main
thing. I don't know if that survey was conducted in his living room. But
yeah, because
no,
he was not great.
Look, the thing with him is you have to be very careful, because you can't go overboard. Sam Allardyce has his uses as a coach. He is a fantastic firefighter who can come in and do a job. His methods aren't instantaneous. They take a little bit of time to be sort of sunk in and adapted to by the squad that he inherits. But assuming you've kind of got the players that he can use, he'll keep you in the Premier League year on year. That's fine. The problem is that he came to a club in Everton that had just spent a ton of money, broken their transfer record, I think, two or three times in the same summer, you know, climaxing with Gylfi Sigurdsson. And they had ambitions past what he wanted to do. And I appreciate that there are supporters of him who will say, well, he finished eighth. He finished eighth on 49 points. Most seasons, that won't get you eighth. So in the same way that, again, the teams that finished ninth and 10th did so on what is comparatively a low-scoring Premier League season for that aspect of the table, you have to give that context to Sam Allardyce as well. And yes, his home record wasn't terrible. It's his a rare record that I think really did him over personally. But even then, I think the problem he has is that he had an opportunity with Everton to, I would say, almost reinvent his character and how he was perceived in the game, and maybe give credence to those infamous Allardyce comments that still kind of haunt him a little bit. And instead, he doubled down and went further into his burrow of a fairly regressive, reactive football that looked to shut the opponent down rather than, cripple them with your strength. So there's part of me that doesn't have a lot of sympathy for Sam Allardyce, because I also think that when he gets put forth with criticism, he really doesn't handle it well. If anything, he seems to come out swinging, and I never understand why he does that, but that's his own thing to deal with. But yeah, I think he's got his uses, but they're never going to be for a club like Everton that want to finish eighth.
Looks like Marco
higher,
Silva.
Excuse me.
Yeah, it looks like Marco Silva could be the successor, I'm sure. Everton will be looking for him to take them above eighth and challenge those top six. They've just appointed a new director of football as well, so there are changes afoot at the club, clearly, as well as at West Ham, Nico. I mean, do we have any more sympathy for David Moyes, who, like Allardyce, has left his club after 6 months in charge? Moyes, though, slightly different situation, guiding West Ham to survival, took over in November when they were in the relegation zone. In the end, they finished 13th. Moyes was expected, I think, to stay on, but there seems to have been a decision made in recent days that it's for the best interest of everyone involved to go their separate ways. Any sympathy there for you?
No, not at all. I think Chris put it exceptionally well. Those managers have served their purpose. They can keep you in the Premier League. They can, you know, demonstrate or put together an adequate defensive system at the very top of the game in the Premier League and other teams like that. But when it comes to playing actual football, having the onus of possession, like teams like Everton and West Ham should have, and I think that's largely why we saw David Moyes and Gary Neville, even though the managers are slightly different and the experience is obviously vastly different, that's why we saw those guys struggle when they went to Spain, is because that is much more of a league where you need to be able to possess the ball. And it's so, I think it's so important to illuminate the fact that it's not just about possessing the ball, because you can inflict more harm on yourself by possessing the ball poorly or for no reason at all and not do anything with it than you can by simply ceding possession and looking to defend like on your goal line. You will do more damage to yourself if you have no idea what you're doing with the ball than if you, you know, if you are actively making mistakes, let's say. And I think that's where the fallacy of these old English dinosaurs kind of comes, is that, yeah, they can get you 49 points. And like Chris said, that's not this year. It's eighth. That's great. In years past and hopefully in years future, that will not be good enough. And that's the issue here, is that I think English clubs that are looking to better their station in the Premier League should be looking at coaches like Francesca, maybe Lucien Favre, other guys around Europe that can clearly and demonstrably put together a style of football that looks to have possession the majority of the time, because when you want to be better than the majority of the teams, you have to possess the ball.
Well, what about Rafa Benitez, Chris? West Ham reportedly ready to make an approach for the Newcastle manager. I'm guessing you're not going to feel too positive about that one.
You're going to get your bleep machine ready. No, genuinely, I don't debate that there's interest there. It's really brilliantly timed that you've come to me right now, because there are actually reports coming out of Chile, he says optimistically, that Manuel Pellegrini is the new West Ham manager.
Really?
Which would, in theory, fit with the Cluedo-style statement that David Sullivan released, in which he talked about someone who's performed at the top, both, I think he said, in England and in Europe. It was one of those things where when it first came out, I think it might have been Jacob Steinberg in The Guardian, with the help of Louise Taylor, their Northeast correspondent, who reported that, I think they said people at Newcastle were now concerned about Rafa's future and that he may be sort of slipping away from Newcastle. I'm heavily paraphrasing there, by the way. So that, it seems, was maybe a little bit premature. I think at the same time, honestly, you're watching two people in Rafa Benitez and Mike Ashley who are so willing to play politics in the newspapers and know that if someone close to Rafa Benitez goes to The Guardian and says, yeah, looks like he's going to leave, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on, they're going to run with that, because why wouldn't they? Like, why wouldn't you want the potential scoop on that Rafa Benitez may join West Ham? At the same time, I sense that maybe there's been just a little bit of brinkmanship in trying to squeeze Mike Ashley's hand and grip on the situation to get what Rafa wants. Because I think, yeah, he knows for a fact if Rafa goes, he's in a lot of trouble. And I'm in a lot of trouble for a few different reasons. So, yeah, it's no surprise to me that this brinkmanship is continuing. it's quite tiring. It's quite, I would be lying if I said it's not just a teensy bit stressful as a supporter. But ultimately, yeah, I think they have to come to some kind of agreement. And if we do have to eventually discuss Rafa Benitez leaving Newcastle, then yeah, you thought punching a horse was bad. Wait until you see what happens next.
Good God. One manager who's not involved in any brinkmanship is, of course, Pep Guardiola. Today he's just signed a new 2-year contract to Manchester City. Nico, as our resident plastic Man City yank, what are your thoughts on Guardiola's new deal?
The first thing I thought, outside of being consumed by overwhelming joy, because I think, you know, Guardiola has already done so much, and I was happy with him after his first year, and this year is just sort of an addition to that. And I was happy when he was appointed because I like the style of football that he plays. I think he's a brilliant manager, and I like really a lot of the things that he's done. But the thing that sort of resonates with me is that he's signing till 2021, but he's also signing till 2021 with an immense degree of expectation. I think a lot of people will look at that and say, okay, if Manchester City don't have a Champions League title by then he has 150% failed. And I think while both him, the people around him, and Manchester City all more than willingly accept that expectation, it is still something, it's still a massive undertaking. So at the same time, I'm massively excited because I'm really just ecstatic and elated to see the development that we'll see under Guardiola, because, you know, I think if we thought this year was something good, I don't subscribe to the idea that there will be a decline in terms of the league form under Guardiola. I think over his career, and there haven't obviously been that many jobs, it's only been Spain and Germany, but over his career, it has been a consistent development of sort of 3-year cycles or 4-year cycles. When he was at Barcelona, it got better. When he was at Bayern Munich, it was better to great to possibly best. And to be on the receiving end of that as a Manchester City fan, I think is something to be exceptionally excited about. The people I think that I feel bad for are those around us. So
the rival fans, the rival clubs. One other final bit of curious football news before we move on to the questions is the future of Gianluigi Buffon, Chris. Largely expected to retire at the end of the season, to leave Juventus, lifting the double. But it turns out his future might not yet be decided. He suggested in a press conference earlier today that he's had a few intriguing offers from elsewhere, not in Italy, but abroad. And now the reports are that PSG are the mystery club that have offered him a 2-year contract. What do you make of that, Chris? Should Buffon finish his career in Paris?
No.
Flat no.
I thought when you said intriguing offers that he was going to be the next YouTube boxing all-star with Michael Oliver.
It's definitely intriguing, yes.
Yeah, it's intriguing, if nothing else. I don't think he should go to Paris Saint-Germain. I appreciate that, you know, he's not a one-club man, but there's a certain element of him, I think, that feels almost synonymous with that one club, which is Juventus. And I worry for him that a move to PSG, it just feels like it's got bad idea written all over it. I could see why he would do it because, again, it's another shot. The Champions League, realistically, it's probably a Liga winner's medal as well, which is never a bad thing to add to the collection. But I think knowing when to step away is one of the hardest things to do in football, but simultaneously, it's one of the most powerful things as well.
I just want to talk about Thomas Tuchel. Officially confirmed as PSG coach. Apparently looking to bring Julian Weigl to the club for some $45 million as well. Do you think this is the perfect marriage? Tuchel, PSG, potentially a player of the caliber of Weigl coming in as well. Does this all just make sense, Nico?
I think the thing that struck me as soon as I heard the news, I guess official news, being that I have extremely weird ideas about these sort of things, is that I really like Tuchel. I really like his style of play. He's basically, you know, he subscribes to the ideas that Pep Guardiola does. He has a very proficient and really exciting style of attacking football that I think in a different universe, you know, Dortmund would be a force in the Champions League right now and probably Bundesliga winners. But that did not pan out for a variety of reasons at Dortmund. But so now we see him at PSG. And I think this is something that Chris and I talked about the other day, is that this obviously this rise of global football and the capitalization of such is leading to the crazy amount of money. And I think what we saw in the past with PSG's last appointment is obviously Unai Emery, a serial Europa League winner, supposedly one of the better coaches in terms of knockout competitions. That's what we expected from him. And I think the general media and the people watching football, as well as the PSG board, kind of expected more success in competitions. But I think this move kind of goes away from that, in the sense that, you know, Tuchel has a more similar style to Guardiola than he does Mourinho or Klopp or anyone else that is going to be exceptionally successful in a cup competition because of the stylistic advantage that those teams tend to have. And so with that, like I said before, I think this is something that Chris and I talked about in the last podcast. PSG are obviously, along with the concrete achievements in the game, the trophies, the league titles, the Champions League success, are still as well looking to make some of their investment back, make that money back. And with that comes being a global brand. And this is something we mentioned in terms of when Manchester City won their Premier League title, they did this thing where in all of the players' hometowns, they put up a projection on a wall, like, thank you, this player that grew up in this hometown, for, you know, being part of this incredible achievement. And it goes along with this, with all these stories that we've been hearing about City Football Group, that they want to be this global brand. And I think PSG, to a certain extent, want the same thing. And that's kind of where the inspiration for this appointment comes from. They don't just want to be a team that, you know, you walk down the road here, I think anywhere in the world now, and you can see a Neymar jersey. They don't just want to be that French team that wins the league every year and, you know, has these amazing footballers that are going to sell shirts. They want to be a global football brand. And how do you do that? You play amazing football. Napoli have proved that. They are probably one of the lesser known teams in terms of, like, not being amongst the European elite, but they have gained this immense sense of notoriety and, you know, market cap, you know, marketability in a sense, because they played some of the best football that I think a lot of us have ever seen. And that same thing goes with Tuchel at PSG, is that they already have the players, they have the capital to continue buying those players, but now they need that style of football. And I think outside of Pep Guardiola, the next best person that you're going to get in order to perpetuate that style of really marketable football is Thomas Tuchel. So I think that is largely where this move.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Resides.
Questions, then. Alice Parry-Jones writes in saying, would Buffon be a good signing for Liverpool? I think based on what we just said, probably not. Alice Parry suggesting maybe she's taking more of a coaching role. Maybe that could work. Taylor Amy says, is the 3-5-2 the best formation for England? What do you make of that, no. Chris? Oh, Nico, you've got opinions. You've piped up. Why not?
I don't think so. I think it's within the wheelhouse of their best formations, but I tweeted out my own personal one when the squad came out. I think it's a 3-4-3. I know there are a lot of concerns about the midfield, but obviously I think if Gareth Southgate is not going to put a great deal of importance on it because of the players that he's decided to take, then you should completely buy into that. And I think having sort of a fluid front three, great podcast, of Raheem Sterling, Dele Alli, and Harry Kane, I mean, that's just amazing. And then sort of the system that I think you can most easily sort of, at least at a very surface level, replicate, which is something that I've talked about being very important at these international tournaments, is Tottenham. And I think if you can have, you know, Trent Alexander-Arnold, who's been really fantastic this season, and Danny Rose have very simplistic sort of wing back, full back winger type roles in terms of just patrolling that flank. And Kyle Walker in a recent interview kind of talked about the not necessarily in an insulting way, but sort of the simplicity of the role that he had at Tottenham compared to the one that he had or occupies currently at Manchester City. If you can employ that with the players that I think are going to be on display for England this summer, combine that with the front three that I just mentioned, and then the defensive solidity, while at the same time the passing ability of the center backs, and Eric Dier and Jordan Henderson or Fabian Delph in midfield, I think you have a really versatile team that can get up and down the pitch and do a lot of cool things. And in a tournament that I think is going to largely depend on being versatile and being having both the ability to be offensively proficient and at the same time really solid defensively, sort of in a transitional sense, I think that's the best team to do it. So for me, it's going to be a 3-4-3.
A similar note, Chris. Luke Dorr writes in, how far do you realistically see England progressing in this tournament? What would be considered a successful tournament? I think by and large, we are expecting England to get out of the group, at the very least, get into that knockout phase. Quarterfinals, would that be a success, do you think, for England, Chris?
Given the last two tournaments, probably, it probably is. Just because of recent history, I think that's the problem, is that you can be very easily lulled into a false perception of self-importance and stature by going far enough back. You know, 66 we won the thing, and Natalia 90 and all this stuff. But yeah, we have to operate on the here and now, and lately we haven't done well in tournaments, so quarterfinals would be lovely.
So let me ask you, England boys, I guess maybe Chris answered the question there, but I mean,
for the listeners, rather... England boys is mine and Adam's rap group.
Wouldn't you rather base the expectations of what you're wanting to achieve, or what you should achieve, I guess, to some extent, on the quality of player that you have, as opposed to the history of it? Or I think it's a particularly interesting question when it comes to England. Yeah, it's far too logical, but when it comes to England, I think it's an interesting topic.
More about whether we get an extra day off during the week to watch the game, really, don't we? It's the wheels of a fan are quite simple in my experience.
Yeah, I think you speak a lot of sense there, Nico. I think a lot of people are expecting still England to get through that group phase, get past the round of 16, quarterfinals would be fantastic. I think people aren't expecting much, considering, you know, it is a very young, experienced squad, hoping for some exciting football, some exciting moments from these players. But, you know, round of 16, quarterfinals, I'd be pretty happy with that. You know, 4 or 5 games. That'll do me. That'll do me. More questions here on Twitter. Nick Saldivius has been saving this one for a while. What if clubs were only allowed to sack hire managers during the transfer windows, but clubs were allowed to hire 2 managers in case the head manager was unable to continue? How would that change football? I mean, it sounds insane. I'm not sure I 100% understand what the proposal is. It sounds
Nick, you sound like a lovely person, but it would ruin football. I can't put it any finer than that. It sounds horrible.
You hire 2 managers, and then if one of them goes, the other one just steps in. So you could potentially, theoretically, have a situation where, Arteta and Thierry Henry are sitting there, both managers for Arsenal next season, and when one gets sacked, the other one steps in. It doesn't seem like the best situation for managers, for fans, for anyone, Nico?
I have no comment. it would suck. It would be terrible.
What about this question from the big man, Karim Karas? What positions do you think Real Madrid need to improve on in the summer. And what do you make of the rumors in Spain that Neymar is going to Real Madrid? Of course, Real Madrid falling far short of their rivals Barcelona in the league, but could be on course to win a third successive Champions League, which would be incredible. Is Neymar the man to bring in for 200 odd million pounds, Nico, to take them even further, take them to another level?
I think they're at that final level. To say that Real Madrid are not at a certain level would be to ignore a lot of levels. But it's interesting that he says that, because according to Understat, which is an analytics site, Real Madrid should have won the league. they are supposedly underperformed their expected points by quite a bit, and Barcelona overperformed by about 12. So as far as their underachievement, I think it was something that is slightly overblown. Cristiano Ronaldo had that whole dry spell period towards the beginning of the season, which is odd for really anyone of his stature to go that long and really score that few goals in that amount of time, when I think he is usually on pace to score like 40 goals at minimum in any given season. But to kind of pick out a position and say like this is the position that they need to strengthen, I think is really difficult, because they can play a variety of systems. Like they can play a 4-3-3 or a 4-4-2 diamond and really be successful, because they have really a myriad of players that can. Neymar at Real Madrid would be really fun, but I think it would spell the end of Ronaldo, because I can't imagine a situation where A, they can afford that. I would want to play with Neymar, but I could be wrong. So I think as long as they have Ronaldo, they keep it as it is, and then they move on to Neymar if they want.
Jack May, YouTube sensation. Jack May says, if it was compulsory to take three players from the championship to Russia, for England, presumably, who would you pick? And how wank would that rule be?
I was nervous you weren't going to read that last part.
Three championship players to Russia in the England squad, Chris. Ryan Sessegnon is a given, let's say. Is there any other two others that you might take? I mean, there is one name leaping out to me. Big, brave John Terry. Get him on the plane to Russia, no?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a name. That's a person.
That's two down.
That's a person playing in the championship. That is, he definitely fits the...
And he's English.
The legal criteria that's been stated.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It sucks that I really can't think of two better players than John Terry. James Maddison would definitely be one.
Snodgrass.
Snodgrass is Scottish, but we'll not hold that against him. I would definitely take Ryan Sessegnon, James Maddison, and crumbs. I wish I could take.
If you can't say anyone, it's going to be JT.
Ben Gibson.
We were very close to taking JT there, but you saved it. Here's a good question, moving swiftly on, from Tim Eales. In the wake of Buffon's and Liverpool PSG rumours, who is the best experienced player signing in the past? Must have been considered past it or on a free. So who are the best sort of experienced signings out there in football history?
I think I might have got
there. There was someone on Twitter the other day that I think Michael Ballack went to Chelsea on a free.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but he wasn't considered past it, though, to be fair. He was still pretty was he not? Buying. I'm going to say
if
Henry
I could Lass throw this technical
Henry to Man United.
I think if I can throw in this technicality, Yaya Toure, who didn't play at all this season, played a massive role supposedly in the dressing room as to integrating the newer players and making everybody feel at home. And they called him Uncle Yaya, supposedly. So he did it. He did a good job, and he didn't play at all.
I'm pretty sure the question was about players that joined under the idea that they were already past.
Yeah, I was saying technicality, but
I would say Henrik Larsson when he joined Man United, because he was, I think, 37, maybe 37, 38.
You know, it's a good one. Pirlo to Juventus. I don't think it was free, but I think he was definitely considered past it.
That's a great shout. He was free. You could probably pretty much scan through MLS, couldn't you, and say most of the elder, aging chaps that have gone there. So your David Villas and such like. But I don't know if people were saying David Villa was past it, to be fair. I think there's nobody jumping out, really. That's the problem.
Fernando Torres was a good inclusion for Atletico, I think. A lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Gary McAllister, free transfer, 35 years old.
Oh, God, yeah, for Liverpool, that was a fantastic one.
Free transfer.
And Gerard Houllier, yeah, because he scored in the derby, didn't he? He scored that ridiculous free kick from some 35 yards out. That's a great shout.
I feel like we're missing so many, you know, just those players that...
Is there not a Spurs one? Like, I feel like there is a pretty significant Edgar Davids, maybe.
Exactly who you're thinking of, DK. Ryan Nelson from Blackburn Rovers. He came in at the age of 33. Oh, great signing under Harry Redknapp. There was a couple of those in Redknapp's. Luis Saha played about 5 good games. Adebayor, maybe, I guess. But I'm struggling to think of anyone else. I think Rafa van der Vaart wasn't really past it when he joined Spurs.
He joined from Real Madrid, didn't he?
Yeah, he was just sort of a bit of a Real Madrid reject.
Well, when anyone moves to Spurs, it's like they must be past it, you know?
Hold on. Hold your horses here. there's a lot we're missing out. Guys, tweet us. We're missing out so many. Look, a player that, you know, everyone thinks is past it. They go on for one last contract. They've still
Martin
got it.
Martin de Michelis.
Yeah, I like that.
Basically players that had an Indian summer. Is that a fair way to characterise it?
Yeah, I think that's very much a fair way to go. I'd love people to tweet us, guys, with your suggestions. At the front three, get them in. Okay, final couple of questions then. Drew writes in, if Jose wasn't Manchester United manager, what a world we'd live in. What manager would be best suited to deliver their desired attacking style? Thanks, lads. Love the pod. Thanks, Drew. Nico, if Jose wasn't at Manchester United, that exact same squad that's there right now was in place, not Pep Guardiola, who would be the man to come in and deliver that attacking football the fans demand?
I would say, I don't think, let's erase the past 2 years and say Conte never goes to Chelsea. I think he would have done a pretty decent job. He probably would have done the same thing that he did at Chelsea. Like, he would have probably won it in his first year because there were enough pieces there, and especially the type of like Conte player that there was, like Ashley Young or at Valencia at right back. Like, there are enough players there that not a lot of people think are really that good, and he would have made, I think, the best out of them, maybe with a different signing or two. And he probably would have done the same thing. Like, he would have won it in the first year and then done okay the second year, maybe not missed out on Champions League. It kind of depends. But I think Conte would have done a decent job. I also think that team, like I said in the PSG bit, like Tuchel or really any possession manager that has worked at the very top before would be a good idea for Manchester United, because Manchester United for so long want to perpetuate this image that they are a winning team, they are the best team in Manchester, they want beautiful style of football, and they very, very much have not achieved that under Mourinho. They play average, not so great football in terms of aesthetically, and they have achieved certain things, but they are certainly not where they want to be, I think. So Tuchel or Conte would be fun.
Good shouts. Here's an interesting one from Waldo. Which exciting team from this season can you see losing their star players just as Monaco did last season? Obviously, Monaco was so fantastic last season, picked apart by some of the elite clubs in Europe. All their big players, or most of their big players, leaving for huge fees. Is there a team really like that in Europe this season that you think is susceptible?
Napoli.
Napoli, really? Who do you think could be on the move from Napoli? Let alone.
Well, the majority of those guys have. That's the thing, is that the majority of those guys have come out and said that it all depends kind of on what their manager does. They will only stay if he stays. Husin, who's their right back, who's been a really large part of that team, is largely dependent on Sarri. I think Koulibaly is largely dependent on Sarri, as well as Jorginho De City is apparently already done. And then Mertens might see out the rest of his career elsewhere and just try to make a ton of money in China if Sarri leaves. I could see Callejon seeking greener pastures. I mean, a lot of that is so dependent as to whether Sarri stays. But yeah, I could definitely see them getting picked apart, especially since some of their younger guys, Marco Rog, Amadou Diawara, and Piotr Zielinski, are really, really talented central midfielders that a lot of other teams could just come along and say, you know, your wage in Italy is literally terrible. We could improve that like 6 times over and not really break the bank.
Sad news for Napoli fans there. You heard it here first. Your whole team is about to get picked apart. guys, that does bring an end to the front three on that hopeful note there. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, the Q&A. We didn't get through all the questions, but do keep them coming in. We'll favourite the ones that we didn't get around to for next week. Do follow us on Twitter at the Front Three. That's where we get the questions from, so make sure you follow us there. Make sure you review the podcast as well. If you want to be whole of the week, click on the link in the description of this very podcast you're listening to. But until Monday, when we'll be back once again, guys, me, Chris, where can people find you?
In your hearts and minds.
Moving, very moving and emotional. Nico?
They can find me on Twitter at Nico_O'Morales. I recently did something with The Athletic that will be up in a few days. It's about the Champions League final, ISCO, the like. So look out for that.
Good stuff. Guys, you can follow me at Adam Boltwood on Twitter. Keep your eyes on the XO YouTube channel. In the next week, we'll probably be putting up our interview with Xabi Alonso, which went to film yesterday, which Lawrence McKenna loved. He's never been so nervous in his life, he said, before we spoke to Xabi Alonso. But yeah, fantastic experience. And interestingly enough, when we asked him about Mikel Arteta going to Arsenal, they're BFFs, you know, what's going on, Xabi? Is Arteta moving? Xabi said, I can't say much. So you heard it here first. Get all your money on Arteta to Arsenal if you haven't already. But do look out for that on the XO channel next week. We will see you guys on Monday. Until then, have a bloody great week. Enjoy the FA Cup final.
Three, that's a magic number. Three. Yes, it is. It's the magic number. Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community was born three, they stubbed me, and that's a magic number.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.